The Spoken Word Library presents A Control for Cancer, a lecture by Dr. Ernst T. Krebs, Jr., the world-renowned discoverer of vitamins B15 and B17. In this lecture, Dr. Krebs presents a biochemist's view of the origin of cancer, its nature, and its control. He not only describes those factors which cause cancer in the otherwise healthy body, but he presents also a detailed explanation of how nature, if only given a chance to do so, provides a counter-mechanism to prevent it. The startling conclusion of Dr. Krebs' analysis is that cancer is not caused by some kind of mysterious virus, as many modern scientists are trying to prove, but instead really is nothing but a deficiency disease, like scurvy or pellagra, aggravated by the lack of an essential food compound in modern man's diet. The rate of cancer is highest in those advanced nations, where foods have become highly refined, preserved, synthesized, and otherwise denuded of their original nutritional elements. Yet cancer is almost unheard of in those regions where foods are more basic and less processed. And in some of these areas, people enjoy a much longer life expectancy, too, in spite of the lack of modern medical care. Medical schools in the United States are richly endowed by the large and prosperous drug firms. The old-time medical societies and their journals also largely are financed and dominated by drug interests. There is no doubt that this is why a large part of the medical establishment today is hostile to the thesis presented by Dr. Krebs. The AMA, the FDA, and the American Cancer Society have all joined in the cry of fraud and quackery. Meanwhile, a growing number of doctors all around the world are applying the Krebs theory to their own patients, and the favorable results are increasingly hard to ignore. Unfortunately, the trend now within the United States is to arrest and harass all doctors who favor this approach. We believe that such tactics do not advance the cause of honest scientific inquiry. Whether Dr. Krebs is right or wrong in his theories, it is not the role of government to decide. History has shown that governments often have institutionalized and perpetuated error in scientific questions. We believe in complete freedom of choice for both physicians and patients to use whatever therapy they mutually accept. Truth will prevail only when all sides of an issue are presented freely for evaluation and debate. It's with this thought in mind that the Spoken Word Library is pleased to present now Dr. Ernst T. Krebs.
Thank you. Tonight we're going to report briefly to you on the progress being made with Leotril, or vitamin B17, the generic term of which is nitrilicide. This report will not only concern the progress that is made in the United States, but it will also concern the progress that is being made in the more than 20 foreign countries in which this factor is widely used. I'm informed that perhaps 70% of the audience tonight is here for the first time, so the 30% of you who have heard the story once before, please bear with those who have not heard it before. As a Methodist circuit rider once said, no man is entitled to hear the gospel twice till all have heard it at least once. So, what is Leotril anyway? Leotril, first of all, is a non-toxic, water-soluble, accessory food factor that, when purified, forms white crystals that are slightly bitterish and sugary in texture. Leotril is thus a new vitamin. A vitamin is simply an accessory food factor necessary for the physiological well-being of one or more animal types. Now, leotril is found in over 1,200 different plants. This vitamin is found with greater ubiquity in higher concentration than any other known vitamin, with the possible exception of ascorbic acid. The richest sources of vitamin B17 are the seeds of all the common fruits, the seeds of apricots, peaches, plums, prunes, pears, nectarines, and quince. These seeds contain from 1 to 2%, which is a prodigious concentration for a vitamin or an accessory food factor. These seeds contain 1 to 2% of vitamin B17 or nitrilicide. Now, in South Africa, which incidentally is, according to the anthropologists, the cradle of the human race, many other plants contain vitamin B17. The South African yam, sweet potato, the lettuce that's grown in South Africa, and one report tells us that even the rice grown in South Africa contains vitamin B17. In this hemisphere, the cereal that is very rich in vitamin B17 or nitrilicide is, of course, millet, a member of the great sorghum family. Another cereal very rich in vitamin B17 is flax, prodigiously rich in this factor. Another is buckwheat. Now, wheat is notably devoid of vitamin B17, not only in its domesticated form, but any of those forms that may have been the progenitors of domestic wheat or white that are deficient in or completely lacking in vitamin B17. Wheat is something of a mystery because it doesn't have a wild counterpart in nature, and in that way it is an exception to the buckwheat, which grows wild in nature, millet and milo and flax, and most of these other cereals have a wild counterpart. All of the members of the bean family were originally very rich in vitamin B17. For example, 2 2/10 pounds or 1 kilogram of the beans, the lima beans of Peru, contained as much as 1,750 milligrams of vitamin B17. This is for 2 2/10 pounds or 1 kilogram. Special strains of lima beans, such as Scarlet Runner, are inordinately rich in B17, may contain as much as 10,300 milligrams per kilogram. Originally, maize or Indian corn, before intense hybridization, cultivation, and artificial manipulation, was a rich source for vitamin B17. In this hemisphere, there's no longer any vitamin B17 in Indian corn or maize. Then we look at the common fodder grasses, and among them we find Johnson grass, another member of the great sorghum family, to be extremely rich in vitamin B17 or nitrilicide, the proprietary or medical term of which is leotril when applied to problems of human neoplasia. Similarly with Sudan grass, Tunis grass, velvet grass, these one time were the major grazing grasses. Arrow grass is extraordinarily rich in the factor. It sometimes contains as high as 75,000 to 100,000 milligrams per kilogram of the vitamin. The members of the rose family, that is the peach, apricot, cherry, apple, nectarine, so forth, these fruits, all members of the great family Rosacea, the rose family, contain, as we have said, 1 to 2% vitamin B17 in their seeds. We're speaking here of the domesticated form, of course. And when we speak of seeds, we're referring to the, obviously, the edible seed within the pit. Some publicists and some journalists and even some FDA people seem to suffer great confusion in trying to distinguish between the pit of a fruit and the seed of a fruit. It's a family presentation, so I won't go beyond that. But the apricot pit is, you know, it's a very tough pit, but it may be easily cracked with a proper nutcracker. And this yields the almond-like seed. This seed contains 1 to 2% of the factor. Now, when you eat an apple and you break the black covering of the apple seed and squeeze out the white, meaty pulp, you notice a very pungent, bitter almond flavor. This bitter almond is due to the benzaldehyde, which is associated with the cyanide. That benzaldehyde arises with the breakdown of vitamin B17. Now, we've mentioned these concentrations in the domestic plants on which man feeds, but in the wild counterpart of these plants, wild apricots, wild peaches, wild cherries, all the wild counterparts, the vitamin B17 content extends far beyond the seed. It's incorporated in the fruit of the plant, in the leaves, and in the barks, and the branches, and so forth. And keep in mind that agriculture, depending on the part of the world at which we look, is barely 8,000 years old. And preceding this, man relied upon, obviously, plant food that was not cultivated, but on plant food that grew wild. And this plant food, as we see through the example of all the fruits, was extremely rich in vitamin B17. But with cultivation, this vitamin disappeared from everything but the seeds of most of these fruits. So we can see now that there is a very, very strong dietary basis for vitamin B17 in the biological experience of both man and animals. Now, what happens when inadvertently a profound but almost total deprivation of this vitamin is brought about through the blind forces of technology and commerce, of exploration, politics, so forth? What happens when this vitamin is pulled out of the dietary of civilized man? Does he, as a result, suffer a deficiency disease? The answer is, of course, yes. And what is the deficiency disease from which he suffers? This deficiency disease is cancer. So that one-third of all of us living in the so-called civilized areas of the world, subsisting on the westernized diet, develop frank clinical malignancy before we die. These are the figures of the American Cancer Society. And these figures refer only to the diagnosable lump or bump or erosion or cavitation, that which is apparent to the examining physician. And beyond this one-third, there are the rest of us who are killed by intercurrent diseases or don't live long enough for the manifestation of malignancy. But all of us, in the course of our lifetime, because of this fulminating and ubiquitous dietary deficiency, are developing neoplastic or cancer cells, cells that remain either at the subclinical level or, in the case of one-third of us, come into blossom as frank clinical malignancy. Not only among westernized men, but equally among his domestic pets. The American Veterinary Association, for example, has shown that the incidence of cancer in cats and dogs parallels the incidence of cancer in their masters. And I imagine most of you have seen that when cats and dogs are released from the concrete warrens or what amount to them the ghettos of modern living, these animals will race out to the garden or to the park and seek out plants and begin eating grass. You ask, well, why does a dog or cat eat these grasses? And when you begin examining these grasses, you find that these are Johnson grass or arrow grass, tunas grass or velvet grass or white clover. All of these grasses that are extremely rich in vitamin B17, they feel an instinctive need for this. Now, some of you may come to the false conclusion that if we avoid, now it's extremely important to avoid diethylstilbestrol in our meat, granted. It's extremely important not to smoke, particularly cigarettes, granted. It is true that those who don't smoke cigarettes are 40 times less apt to develop cancer of the lung. And the Seventh-day Adventists, incidentally, have provided excellent statistics for this. However, if you do not smoke and if you do not eat meat with diethylstilbestrol, the incidence of cancer among you will be precisely what the incidence of cancer is among all the rest of us. to Seventh-day Adventist males who don't smoke don't develop lung cancer, but the total incidence of cancer among Seventh-day Adventists is just the same as the total incidence of cancer among all of us, because the determining factor for malignancy systemically is this dietary deficiency. The carcinogen determines the site at which this deficiency is manifest. You can understand that carcinogen localizes it. Now we come to the next logical thing that must occur in your minds, because science is a self-answering process from which the normal human mind makes its own deductions, so it's probably occurred to many of you already in anticipation. Well, what happens to those societies, those few cultures in the world in which there isn't this great dietary deficiency in vitamin B17 or this great dietary deficiency in these cyanide sugars? If this vitamin B17 is anti-neoplastic or anti-cancer, why aren't these societies exempt? This is an excellent question. Of course, they are exempt. We see this exemption in the tribes that live in the foothills of the Himalayas. Now, these people have a dietary extremely rich in vitamin B17. Their country is designated in the National Geographic and other publications as land where apricot is king. And in the early days of this work, this population was drawn to my attention as being completely cancer-free. And I superficially dismissed this suggestion with the statement, well, if they can eat all of the apricot fruit they choose to eat, this doesn't contain vitamin B17, they would have to eat the seed. Then investigating the matter further, we found that the apricot seed is a prized food among the Hunsakuts. They eat it, not only the raw seed, but they break the seed and make a beverage that is extremely rich in B17 from it. And in addition to the apricot seed, they have the following vegetables that growing in abundance there, very rich in nitrilicide. You see their soil is dry and relatively high in nitrogen, and as a result, the vitamin B17 content of these vegetables is very high. These vegetables are buckwheat. They don't rely on wheat. They use buckwheat as a cereal. They use millet. They use the broad bean, Vishya faba, the lima bean. They use the little-known cereal of vetch. They eat the seeds of all of the fruits. They rely heavily on berries, and berries are very rich in vitamin B17. So in investigating the Hunsakuts, a people described as not yielding a single case of cancer, these people take not only the apricot seed, but everything they eat is, by way of plant food, is very rich in vitamin B17. Now, does it follow from this, however, that vitamin B17, nitrilicide, is a priori the anti-neoplastic or anti-cancer vitamin? Logically, no. Of and by itself, it doesn't follow. But let's examine vitamin B17. What does it comprise? It comprises a molecule consisting of a submolecule, let us call it in lay terms, a submolecule of benzaldehyde, another submolecule of hydrogen cyanide, and another molecule or two of ordinary sugar or dextrose. These three different molecules are condensed in a sugary substance that is totally non-toxic, or as non-toxic as anything can be. As Dr. Dean Burke of the National Cancer Institute has shown, vitamin B17 isn't any more toxic, if as toxic as ordinary sugar. Now we seem to come into a paradox. If it is so totally non-toxic, how can it kill something as devastatingly virulent as the neoplastic or cancer cell? It kills the neoplastic or cancer cell as a result of an enzyme called beta-glycosidase that the cancer neoplastic cell contains. Only the cancer cells contain this enzyme, beta-glycosidase. This enzyme, when exposed to the vitamin B17 molecule causes that molecule to break down. It releases one molecule of hydrogen cyanide, HCN, one of the most poisonous chemicals known. It also releases another highly toxic molecule, benzaldehyde. But it doesn't stop here. The combined cytotoxic or cell-killing effects of these two molecules is not the arithmetical sum of their separate effects, but their combined activity is an expression of what in pharmacology we call a synergism. That is, the poisonous or cell-killing effect of one multiplies the cell-killing or poisonous effect of the other by 100 to 150 times. Okay, just as the cancer cell contains beta-glycosidase, so the cancer cell lacks an enzyme that is found in every other cell of the body, every non-cancerous cell of the body. And this enzyme is called rhodanase, or ethylcyanate transsulfurase. And this enzyme, rhodanase, protects normal cells from a relatively high concentration of cyanide. So we see in the cancer cell not only a chemical that breaks down the vitamin B17 to two extremely powerful cellular poisons, cyanide and benzaldehyde, but we see the cancer cell totally lacking an enzyme that normally protects cells against such cyanide, an enzyme called rhodanase. The surrounding or contiguous body or somatic cells contain relatively high concentrations of this enzyme rhodanase, so that when the cancer cell breaks down the molecule to hydrogen cyanide and benzaldehyde, the hydrogen cyanide that might spill over to the body cells is harmlessly detoxified by the enzyme rhodanase to a compound called thiocyanate that is 200 times less toxic than cyanide. Now, the thiocyanate so produced plays a very important role in the metabolism of the organism. This thiocyanate is what we call a hypertensive agent and brings about a physiological lowering in blood pressure. Now, this mechanism we have described is very real. There's nothing speculative about it. It is thoroughly, exhaustively, conclusively, and independently established by the studies of veterinarians, by students of human physiology, and so forth. The veterinarians who have studied it, for example, have studied the effects on animals in eating white clover that is extraordinarily rich in vitamin B17. And these animals that eat this clover show a concentration of this detoxification or breakdown product thiocyanate in their blood and urine about 10 to 20 or 30 times higher than is found for those animals not eating the vitamin B17 rich plant material. And so it is with people who live in areas of the world in which the dietary is still rich in vitamin B17. Their thiocyanate level in the blood and urine and tears is 15 to 20 or 30 times higher than it is in Western man. This is true among the Nigerians, for example. And independent workers at the University of Michigan and Rockefeller University, some of you may have noticed, have determined that cyanate in non-toxic doses is a highly effective measure against the crises of sickle cell anemia. And the cyanate level is built up in the bloodstream by eating foods very rich in nitrilicide. And this, to us, explains why those carrying the sickle cell characteristic in South Africa and living on the native diet do not develop the sickle cell crises, but when they leave their natural habitat and go on westernized diet, they prove to be highly susceptible to the sickle cell crisis. Now, the cancer cell is simply the trophoblast cell, a normal cell in the animal life cycle, and this cell is cancer when it exists at the wrong time in the wrong place. The trophoblast cell is the most primitive cell in the life cycle. And now let's trace the trophoblast cell in the development of each of us, commencing with the beginning of life as it occurs with the fertilization of the female gamete or ovum in the upper one-third of the fallopian tube. It is joined in fertilization by the male element, and now we have what the embryologist calls a zygote. It's existing technically in a site anatomically exterior to the body, existing on the moist, warm mucous membranes of the fallopian tube. Now this product of conception or conceptus is destined to cancerize the body of the mother, the maternal host, albeit in a physiologically canalized way. And when this product of conception reaches the cavity of the uterus, it is the trophoblast cells that erode, infiltrate, digest, and open the channels of the maternal host to the nutritive requirements of the oncoming being. And it's the trophoblast cells, the first cells in the life cycle, that are responsible for this mechanism. This is the reason that Dr. Hertig at Harvard, in his classical monograph on the human trophoblast, has aptly described the trophoblast as God's first cancer and man's first cure. That cure is achieved as we come into the world, because it is the gradual destruction of the trophoblast and the elimination of its hormones that marked the epoch of birth. So cancer is simply this: trophoblast at the wrong time and at the wrong place. Now the trophoblast is productive of chemicals called hormones, and notable among these is a hormone called chorionic gonadotropin, abbreviated HCGH, human chorionic gonadotropic hormone. And it is this hormone that serves as the basis for the standard pregnancy test. The urine of the woman of suspected pregnancy is examined for the presence of this HCGH. Now this is produced by the trophoblast. Now if cancer is actually trophoblast at the wrong time and the wrong place, it is not unreasonable for us to expect to find in the presence of cancer this hormone produced only by trophoblast cells. Of course, this hormone has been found in the body fluids and in the urine of cancer patients. And just a few months ago, workers at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, have found this chorionic gonadotropin in urines and in the blood sera of patients with the most diverse exhibitions of cancer, ranging from Hodgkin's disease to adenocarcinoma of the stomach to sarcoma, and most excitingly, to the leukemias themselves. The presence of this hormone has confirmed for us the fact that the leukemias too represent an expression of cancer at the wrong time and the wrong place in the life cycle. Reflect back that cancer at the right time and the right place in the life cycle is seen in the normal placenta. Now if the trophoblast in that normal placenta persists beyond a certain period in the life cycle, if it persists beyond the 56th day at the same level it exists at the 50th day, that trophoblast is inevitably exhibited as the most malignant of all exhibitions of cancer, and it is characterized by the presence in prodigious quantities in the urine and other body fluids of this marker, this HCGH, the human chorionic gonadotropic hormone. Now, the National Cancer Institute workers, as I say, have independently discovered the presence of trophoblastic hormone, much to their frank amazement, because they haven't done this work with any preconception toward the Unitarian or trophoblastic thesis or fact of cancer. They've done it just as an empirical, pragmatic, experimental procedure. Now, another very important contribution, evidentiary of the Unitarian or trophoblastic nature of cancer, evidentiary of the fact that cancer is trophoblast at the wrong time, the wrong place, is that of Mitsuoma Yokoyama, the director of research at the Kuakini Medical Research Institute in Hawaiian Islands. He has found trophoblastic protein
in the body fluids, specifically in the sera of suspect cancer patients, in 88 to 92% of these patients. He has found the same hormone, of course, in 100% of all cases of pregnancy examined, and he has found it in only 3% of those cases that are presumably non-cancerous, that is, those who do not present clinical evidence of malignancy. Now, Manuel D. Navarro, one of our associates working at the University of St. Tomas Medical School in Manila, has, of course, been routinely identifying this chorionic gonadotropin in the body fluids of cancer patients for the last 10 years, and within the context of the Unitarian atrophoblastic thesis of cancer. Dr. Contreras' test runs an accuracy, reputedly, of 96 to 98%, and he has found the chorionic gonadotropin in the body fluids of presumably non-cancerous patients to the extent of 6% of the population. At first, he considered this an experimental artifact until he observed that after the passage of 6 months, 8 months, or a year or so, many of these so-called false positive reactors were coming into bloom with clinical malignancy. And upon seeing this, he said that he could not tolerate the idea of waiting for this to occur. So routinely, he administers vitamin B17 or Laetril to these so-called false positive reactors. And their test then goes negative, and they don't come into clinical bloom. Now at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Drs. Coggins and Andrews at the Atomic Energy Commission's Laboratory on Developmental Chemistry have just recently reported their conclusions that cancer indeed represents cells normal to the life cycles, but cells occurring at the wrong time in the wrong place. This is gratifying, of course. Drs. Andrews and Coggins miscall these cells embryonal cells. And there is a very important distinction between true embryonal cells and definitively trophoblastic cells. And it is a failure of embryologists to sharply make this distinction in the teaching of medical schools that has provided us with a theoretical universe from which cancer is conclusively excluded. So it's very, very important for us to understand the tremendous dichotomy that exists between trophoblast and all non-trophoblast cells in the animal life cycle. It's the trophoblast cells, and only the trophoblast cells, that are normally malignant, physiologically malignant, and that are exhibited certainly with malignancy when they occur at the wrong time and or place. It is simple as that. It is simple as EMC squared. Now, Dr. Judah Folkman of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Harvard has also contributed richly to the concept of the Unitarian or trophoblastic thesis of cancer. Without prior design, without intent, when he demonstrated a factor in the presence of all cancers in man and animals, and this factor is called TAF. That's the abbreviation for the angiogenesis factor. And Judah Folkman and his associates have demonstrated that this factor, when it is introduced into the animal body, causes the very rich and abundant development of fine blood vessels, of fine vascular tissue, of very fine veins and arteries. They technically refer to this as neovascularization. Now, why does the cancer cell contain TAF? And incidentally, Dr. Folkman found the only other place in the animal organism in which TAF is found, normally or otherwise, is in the placenta. And it is the trophoblast of the placenta in which TAF is formed. And it is because the trophoblast has been equipped to open up the blood channels of the mother or the maternal host in order to meet the impelling needs for nutrition of the oncoming embryo, that the production of TAF occurs in trophoblast. And because cancer is trophoblast at the wrong time in the wrong place, Judah Hoffman, working completely oblivious to the context or the fact of the trophoblastic nature of cancer, has turned up this piece of magnificent evidence, doubly so because it was gained without any attempt to justify or substantiate the pre-existing theoretical concept. Now, the trophoblast cell, as we've seen, is cancer at the wrong time, a wrong place, and it's obvious now that cancer is a cell that has its normal counterpart in the life cycle. And when we stress the logical impossibility of finding any alternative to this, we may examine briefly the alternative to this concept. And this alternative is that cancer doesn't have a counterpart in the life cycle. Now, if it doesn't have a counterpart in the life cycle, it represents a cell that must perforce arise as a result of spontaneous generation. Well, we know that no cell in the animal or plant kingdom can conceivably arise from spontaneous generation. This was a fallacy or superstition that was thrown out of organized biology at around the close of the 19th century by such giants as Polizzini, Redi, and Louis Pasteur. So if the cancer cell is not a spontaneously generated cell, it is a cell then that has a normal counterpart in the life cycle. The most primitive cell in that life cycle is trophoblast, and there is nothing that the trophoblast cell does that the cancer cell does not do. There's no attribute possessed by the cancer cell that is not shared by the trophoblast cell. There's no attribute that is possessed by the trophoblast cell that is not shared by the cancer cell. And we have cataloged over 200 properties common to both and not found except in both. Common and exclusive to both. 200 properties. There is no difference between the trophoblast and the cancer cell. Now, this fact was originally enunciated on the basis of exquisitely fine experimental investigation on the embryology of the dogfish, Elasmobranch, and on the embryology of the smooth skate. And this was done by John Beard, and it was published in 1902 in a British medical journal called The Lancet. It was published on 21 June 1902 and further extended in a publication in the same journal, Lancet, on October the 29th, 1904. So the identity and nature of the trophoblast cell has been with us this entire century. The trophoblast, of course, is the key to the kingdom, the cancer problem. There's not only one hormone produced by the trophoblast cell, and exclusively by the trophoblast cell, there are at least six or seven. And each one of these hormones is produced only by the trophoblast cell, and every one of these hormones now has been found at one time or another by independent investigators in every exhibition of cancer. That is, cancer of the breast, cancer of the prostate, cancer of the pancreas gland, cancer of the lymphoid tissue, the lymphatic leukemias, cancer of the bone marrow, the myelogenous leukemias. Now, recall what we said about HCGH. You can see how exciting it is to find these workers at NCI reporting this year that chorionic gonadotrophin is coming across in lymphatic leukemias, in the myelogenous leukemias, in Hodgkin's disease, and in cancer of the pancreas. It is just as impossible to have chorionic gonadotrophin, the exclusive product of the trophoblast cell, present in cancer and cancer not to be trophoblast, as it would be to have horse liver present in a fish. Now, there is one aspect of this problem that for years has puzzled some sincere students of the trophoblastic fact of cancer, and this is that under ordinary light microscopy, the examination of malignant lesions doesn't always disclose cells that look identical with the cells of pregnancy trophoblasts. However, with the advent of electron microscopy and the careful examination of that portion, the human placenta that abuts on the uterus of the maternal host or mother, the junctional zone, this electron microscopy has given us the reason why we don't find frank trophoblast and that is the trophoblast hybridizes with the adjacent or the contiguous body or somatic cells through little apertures called desmosomes. It bridges the genetic information in the cytoplasm of the trophoblast in the form of RNA is transmitted to the hostile or somatic cells. Electron microscopy has demonstrated this conclusively at the junctional zone in the human and other placentae. So what we have discussed up to this point is as real as the law of gravitation, the fact that it may not be universally accepted and implemented. The moment is beside the point, because scientific truth is not reliant upon popular plebiscite. Now, as we have seen, there is no contradiction to the Unitarian or trophoblastic fact of cancer. Now we take the next step. There is no contradiction of the anti-neoplastic fact of vitamin B17 or nitrilicide. There isn't a scientist in this country that would come out publicly and attempt to deny this under his own name if he is in a responsible institution, because they would put him down as an idiot. And now the reason for this is very simple. The opposition readily admits, yes, cyanide is poisonous to cancer cells. We know that. Benzaldehyde is poisonous to cancer cells. We know that. But how do we know that vitamin B17 is an intact, harmless molecule, actually breaks down at the malignant cell to release cyanide and benzaldehyde? So we pass that one for a moment. Remember the natural experience of this, that vitamin B17 occurs in nature together with beta-glucosidase, right? And if you take a source of vitamin B17, like the apricot seed, for example, grind it up and defat it, and then just take the dried pulp and to it add water, the beta-glucosidase in there causes the evolution of cyanide and benzaldehyde and two molecules of glucose, and these are anti-neoplastic substances. Right? Right. Now, this is the only conceivable quibble that remains in the entire structure of this science. And this quibble, incidentally, has been resolved. And now we're at the final frontiers of this problem. And these involve questions of politics, question of ego, question of pride of craft. I think the omniscient Nixon administration offering $2 billion to the solution to the cancer problem, and only to have this problem solved at the hands of the, and by the formula, this miserable reactionary free enterprise, where those involved are responsible for themselves and responsible for the things they support and the things they do. This is the story of Leotril. And this forms a very, very striking contrast to the political solution of the problem, because never has the tin cup of mendicancy been rattled in the face of anyone in behalf of the Leotril program. The Leotril problem was solved. The Unitarian and trophoblastic thesis of cancer was derived completely independent of public, private, or any other support. And the history of vitamin B17 reaffirms something very, very basic, and this is that free men can never trust the generals, they can never trust the experts, they cannot even trust the cancer experts, they can't trust their judges, they can't trust their governors or police or anything else, they can trust only themselves, because we have a government that was originally put together to protect the people from the government, and not the government from the people. In the solution of the cancer problem thus far, we've had minor and major problems. Our minor problems have been the scientific one, the problems of discipline, the ordinary problems associated with the economics of research. The major problem has been government obstruction, government interference. And the biggest contribution to the solution of the cancer problem will prove to be getting the government off the backs of all of us. It is not easy to discuss therapy, and as you note, I haven't gone into therapy in any depth here, because these beautiful categorical, axiomatic, uncontradictable facts and realities that underlie the science of this are not applicable in the poor, desperate victim of cancer who, by the time it is diagnosed, is already in the 59th second of the 59th minute of the 11th hour. And the one thing we in Leotril research disclaim is any affinity for magic. We're dealing in a real universe. The time to strike is before the disease occurs. We calculate that if vitamin B17 comes into proper usage, comes into the usage that vitamin C or vitamin B1 or niacin or the rest have come into within a period of 4 years, there should be no new cases of cancer in any part of the civilized world. I italicize civilized world because those who live in the stone culture are backward enough to eat the seeds of fruits and these other things, so they don't have the problem. They don't have the problem of therapy, and they're not conscious of prophylaxis. It comes naturally. It comes automatically. And, of course, this is where all that is great in existence comes. The wit of man is pitifully inadequate to solve any of these basic problems. Now, this sounds like a contradiction coming from a scientist, but it really isn't. If we just go back to our natural roots, we measure everything we do by the yardstick of biological experience. We cannot conceivably do any better than that. Any of you is equipped with a measure more infallible than that possessed by the best medical or biological scientists in the world. Each of you is equipped with this capacity to measure things by the yardstick of biological experience. You ask, should I or should I not do this? Should I expose myself to automobile fumes? You say, what did primitive man do? Should I eat whole food? What did primitive man do? Should I nurse my child? What did primitive man do? Should I fluoridate my water? What did primitive man do? And we can go on and on. Man in the area, this fragile thing called life, in handling this fragile evanescent flame, has devised nothing, can offer nothing. We can do is stand in reverence of the way things are and attempt to understand them the way they are and attempt to live in conformity with the way they are and attempt not to deviate from this magnificent and infinitely wonderful plan on which we cannot possibly improve. Thank you.
Dr. Krebs, do most doctors understand or accept the trophoblastic thesis of cancer?
Thank you, sir. That is a very cogent question. The answer is no. They are not prepared by background, by training, by inclination, maybe congenitally unprepared, but they do not concern themselves with this theoretical or ideological aspect of the problem. I've sometimes generalized to the effect that if one is not exposed to the Unitarian trophoblastic thesis of cancer by the age of 35, he probably is incapable of comprehending it in its totality. Now, this isn't said gratuitously. You owe it to yourself to do some corrosive thinking. It's important that you not be true believers and conclude that vitamin B17 is it and Krebs is something of a prophet, but that you hang a question mark on everything that is said, think about it very intensively, and don't feel inhibited or backward about asking questions, and the more corrosive, the more scathing, the better.
Dr. Krebs, why are you being opposed by those in cancer research?
I do not contend that anybody who's doing cancer research is against us, because 98% to 99% of everything valid published in the area of cancer finds total congruence and illumination in the light of the Unitarian Arthroplastic Thesis of cancer. On the other hand, I don't accept that science is a matter of majority opinion. That which is scientifically valid historically has always been a matter of minority opinion, and in the development of astronomy or any other sciences, there have been men who have been literally burnt at the stake for a scientific belief. And when we consider that in 1928, Alexander Fleming was down as a quack for producing penicillin, and it took a war and 13 years later to bring it into general use, we're not too discouraged about it. Dr. Fleming wrote us just shortly before his death, and he said, stick with it. He said, I never get a commendation on penicillin except that I see in my mind's eyes the millions needlessly dead who would not have been dead if I had stood my ground there and insisted that penicillin wasn't nonsense or moonshine or quackery.
I just wanted to ask, how many raw kernels a day do you feel is a preventative dosage, and do they cause an upset stomach?
How many kernels a day do you feel is a preventative dosage, and do they cause upset stomach? We had a member of the Food and Drug Administration here who was sufficiently articulate. He'd tell you, didn't need any additional vitamins or no minerals or anything, just eat an ordinary good diet. An adequate diet, we would agree with him heartily, if by an adequate diet he means eating whole foods. So if you eat an adequate quantity of fruits and make it a point to eat as many of the seeds as you do the fruits, you will get an adequate quantity of vitamin B17 or nitrolicide. So if you eat 6 prunes for breakfast, eat the 6 seeds that accompany them. One of the earlier statements was to the effect, don't eat apple seeds because they contain cyanide, and cyanide is poisonous. And the late Mr. Rodale did cite a case in which a man developed a neurotic, inordinate desire for apple seeds and ate 3/4 of a cupful of apple seeds and died from the cyanide in it. So this is a good reason for stressing the common sense biological principle of don't eat much more of the seed than you eat of the fruit. So if this gentleman had to eat all those apples, he would have consumed several cases that would have been self-limiting.
In the case of a person who has cancer, is there a time when Laetrile is effective and a time beyond which it won't do any good?
Is there a time period at which Laetrile is effective and a time at which it becomes ineffective? No, these physical chemical reactions move blindly without any purpose or concern so far as the individual as a whole is involved. And if an excessive amount of tissue is involved, and if Laetrile is used, even the removal of all the malignant cells will still be incompatible with the survival of the individual. But Dr. Contreras, whom I consider a superb, dedicated clinician, a credit to medicine, made it a policy 2 years ago to say there is no such thing down here as a hopeless case of cancer. And in my office in San Francisco, I have a roll that carries 8 names, and these represent people who would have been dead if they accepted as final my scientific opinion that they were totally beyond help by Laetrile. And these are people who, after having been assured by me that there's no possible hope for themselves or those for whom they were seeking help, turned to Dr. Contreras and other courageous Laetrile clinicians and received Laetrile, and they're living today. So our doctors happily never say anybody is hopeless as long as he's breathing. Who owns the patents in vitamin B17? There are no patents in the natural vitamin B17,
there are patents on the synthesis of vitamin B17. Where there are patents, these are available to the world because the material is the common property of mankind. And the foundations involved in this work have never received any external support for their work. The work has been done at a great financial sacrifice to the individuals involved. There is no reputable scientist in this country or abroad who will not gladly be given explicit directions for extracting vitamin B17, for identifying it, for producing it, and so forth. I think the most conclusive evidence along this line is the fact that we have freely cooperated with the five laboratories over the world that are producing vitamin B17 in very, very large quantities. And not only have we received no proprietary aggrandizement of any kind, we have refused fees of any sort, and we've entered into this cooperation purely at our own expense. Thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Spoken Word Library, a unique concept in the fields of home entertainment and education. A wide range of pre-recorded programs is offered in such diverse categories as citizenship, health, creation, true life adventure stories, life lesson stories for children, and stories just for fun. A free listing will be sent upon request. Write to American Media, Post Office Box 1365, Thousand Oaks, California, 91360. Duplication of these recordings is prohibited.